The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 24th of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing. We are live from Studio One here in Midori House in London, and I'm Chris Charmack. Coming up on today's program, remember this.
We will stop the steal. Today I will lay out just some of the evidence proving that we won this election and we won it by a landslide.
Yes, that was from January 6th, 2021. We will be finding out why former members of Donald Trump's team are in hot water over his reaction to losing the US presidential election. Also up ahead, with just 2 days to go before Germans head to the polls, the foreign policy expert Daniela Schwarzer will be telling us why Germany's federal election matters to the rest of the world. We'll also be checking in with our team at the Quality of Life Conference in Athens, and Andrew Muller will be offering his characteristically offbeat take on this week's news.
We learned this week that the sinister deep state, which furtively manipulates human destiny for its own nefarious ends, plans to infuse the sinister serum they market as a COVID-19 vaccine into salad dressing. So there was that.
Yes, there was that. It's all coming up right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Charmack. It has now been more than 8 months since protesters stormed Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. But getting to the bottom of exactly what happened on that day, and particularly what role then-President Donald Trump and his team played as the events unfolded, that remains key to preventing such shocking scenes from ever happening again in the United States. The House committee investigating the Capitol riot has now ordered some of Trump's key allies, including his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and senior advisor Steve Bannon, to testify before their inquiry into January's unrest. Let's get the very latest now on this with Scott Lucas. He's an emeritus professor of U.S. politics at the University of Birmingham. Thanks so much for joining us, Scott. Let's just start with how likely is it that Trump's former advisors will actually give testimony to this committee?
Well, the Trump camp will fight this tooth and nail. Trump has already signaled that he's going to try to invoke executive privilege and say that any discussions that he has had with these three men, the former White House chief of staff, Mike Meadows, the former White House chief strategist, Steve Bannon, and Trump's longtime White House social media director, Dan Scavino, are covered by executive privilege. The House, supported by lawyers, are going to argue that no, in fact, executive privilege does not apply in this case, especially since former Trump officials have, at Trump's urging, appeared in other hearings, such as hearings of the Justice Committee, as Trump tries to push back on both the Trump-Russia affair and on his attempt to overturn the election. So no, this may not be imminent. We may have legal contests before subpoenas turn into appearances before the committee, but this does mean that not only the Capitol attack, but that Trump's attempts at what you might even call a coup by overturning the election for weeks beforehand, they will remain on the front pages of U.S. newspapers.
On the front pages, a legal battle, as you say. It's also going to be interesting in part because Joe Biden is now in the White House and in some ways will get to decide what kind of executive privilege exists. I mean, there's also on that a fight over whether the White House of Biden may release details of Trump's movements and conversations on January 6th. I mean, we know what he said publicly. You heard it at the top of this program, and even a fair amount of what was said behind the scenes. What are still, I mean, the open questions that might need to be answered?
Well, I think we can play connect the dots already through a great deal of journalism and through a great deal of public records that have gone out there. And I think you have to consider January 6th in a wider context. There effectively was a for Trump camp to prevent Joe Biden from becoming president and to keep Trump in the White House. The first phase was legal action almost immediately after the November election. More than 60 cases that his lawyers lost in an attempt to throw out election results. The second phase was pressure on state legislators to prevent electors from being confirmed. In other words, to prevent Biden's electoral votes from counting. State legislators held out against that. The third phase was then an effort all the way up to January 5th, which was to get Mike Pence not to confirm Biden's victory as he chaired the Congressional Assembly. You know, this key moment on January 6th when it becomes official that Joe Biden is the 46th president of the United States. When Pence refused to do that, refused to exceed what he saw as his authority and block the confirmation, that's when Trump decided to use that White House rally, which you highlighted in the introduction, to call for not only stop the steal, but to effectively call for a march on the Capitol to prevent Congress from finally putting Joe Biden in as the next president.
So, I mean, Scott, if, as you say, we have already connected the dots in that way, and we all remember the pictures from January 6th, you know, and we frankly, you know, if we're able to connect the dots, we're now having this committee look into it again, bring up this testimony. The country is hugely divided over it. Republicans are still insisting that Donald Trump did not play any significant role and are sort of playing down what happened on the day. Democrats and supporters obviously are on the other side of this, see this as hugely significant. I mean, I guess just the question for me then is, what if anything truly explosive will come out of this committee, and can anything change people's minds and bring us forward here?
Well, I think what you have in terms of the additional material, for example, would be the actual discussions that Trump had with key individuals on January 5th and January 6th. According to a series of journalists, including claims in the book just released by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, Trump celebrated the march on the Capitol and indeed was quite pleased that people had gone into the Capitol, broken into it. And some of those remarks were made to, for example, or in the presence of Dan Scavino, the social media director, and Mark Meadows, the chief of staff. According again to a series of journalists, although Steve Bannon was removed as White House chief strategist in 2017, he remained an informal advisor to Trump, a close informal advisor to Trump, and in the weeks before January the 6th, discussed with Trump not only efforts to overturn the election, but in fact to prevent Biden from being confirmed as president. This, in effect, de facto coup. And so those three men, it is claimed by journalists and, you know, people who have spoken to them, sources, directly heard of Trump's intentions as well as his involvement. Will they confirm that in a public hearing? That's what's at stake. I'd say one other thing. I'd say, you know, I've connected the dots, but this is my job. This is what I'm supposed to do. A lot of people don't have time. They don't have resources to figure out what happened between the election and January 6th. And the Trump camp's tactics have always been to prevent people from learning about that by disinformation, confusion, and denial. So it is important these hearings are held, because a House hearing, that's a little bit more important than a guy named Scott Lucas telling you what happened.
Well, we still appreciate your insights very much, Scott. Thank you very much. That was the U.S. politics expert, Scott Lucas. Now here is Monocle's Alex Self with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Chris. The Catalan separatist leader Carles Puigdemont has been detained in Sardinia on a Spanish arrest warrant. Spain has accused him of sedition, saying he helped organise a wildcat independence referendum in 2017. Puigdemont fled Spain after the vote and now sits as an MEP in Brussels. Authorities in Australia say that more than half of the country's adult population are now fully vaccinated against COVID-19. It comes as Australia grapples with a third wave of infections, which has been driven by the Delta variant. The rise in cases has led to lockdowns in Sydney and Melbourne. Switzerland is to hold a referendum on whether to allow same-sex couples to marry. The Alpine democracy remains one of the few countries in Western Europe that still forbids gay marriage. You can find out more about Sunday's vote by heading to monocle.com/minute. And we're in the thick of this year's Quality of Life Conference, which is taking place in the Greek capital, Athens. We'll have an update from our radio team there in just a moment, but do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for the very latest. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you very much, Lex. To Germany now, where the election campaign to determine who will replace Angela Merkel as chancellor is in its final stages. It's been an extremely difficult race to predict a winner, with three different parties taking the lead over these summer months. For the moment, when Germans head to the polls on Sunday, it is looking like Olaf Scholz of the Social Democrats could claim the party's first victory in two decades in Germany. But Armin Laschet of the Christian Democrats still has yet to throw in the towel, of course. How will Sunday's poll impact Germany's role in the world? Well, for more on this, I spoke just a little while earlier to Daniela Schwarzer. She is Executive Director for Europe and Eurasia at the Open Society Foundations. And I began by asking her what she expects will change when Angela Merkel leaves office.
First of all, the new chancellor will have to establish himself or herself as not only a German and European leader, but also as a leader of a major country in the world, given Germany's economic and political power. And Angela Merkel was known for her political clout, for her resilience in negotiations, but also for her strong appetite for consensus building and really taking others along. And that will actually stay one of the major roles of the German chancellor in the EU27, where divergence is really on the rise. And the question whether Europe has the capacity to act internationally will very much depend on Germany's role in bringing all those different interests together and also lining up common interests with France and actually trying to bring the EU forward. I do not think that the next chancellor will have the ambition for Germany to go it alone, but will really continue to see Germany as a pillar within the European Union and the transatlantic relationship. But of course, the current U.S. policy, for instance, vis-à-vis Afghanistan or vis-à-vis the Indo-Pacific, doesn't make that an easy task for the new German leader.
It doesn't make it an easy task, as you described there, both the U.S. and the European divisions. I mean, you talked there about the need for experience, pragmatism after Angela Merkel. The candidates that are on the ballot on Sunday, they haven't really been challenged too much in this campaign on foreign policy, have they? I mean, do you feel you have a good sense of where they stand and how they differ?
International questions really didn't play a huge role in this campaign. They weren't really set by the candidates, and in the various TV debates, those questions weren't really asked. However, over the past few weeks, the international situation really changed to an extent that I think all candidates had to say something at some point. And what became quite clear is that the Greens mainly took international questions from the climate change perspective and the very big need for the next German leader to actually take the EU, but also international partners along on that agenda, while the CDU, and in particular Armin Laschet in an op-ed which he published yesterday, he looked ahead and said, well, Germany's role is really one of an international leader, and he picks up the topics that he thinks are the priorities for the G7 presidency. So he speaks about the climate agenda, he speaks about economics and trade, and he does speak about China. For Olaf Scholz, he is quite well known, at least on the European scene. He has been the German finance minister who is behind the big recovery plan that the EU put on track in summer 2020. And he is seen in particular from a French perspective as a good partner, because this was a Franco-German initiative that was put on track. And he actually is said to have convinced the German chancellor to go along with him in this major investment project. So many see him as a candidate who will actually play a very positive role for the modernization and the strengthening of Europe, because he has shown with this initiative that he understands the challenges ahead and that there needs to be more European investment into our own modernization and transformation, given climate and digital as the two major challenges.
So climate and digital investment in Europe is one aspect. You did touch at the top also on the aspect of the divisions in Europe also over values and issues like that. I know that has been to some degree a discussion in this campaign. You talked earlier about how Germany, you know, is the one that sort of brings Europe together. Do you think the candidates will be able to do that, or will they have to get more directly involved and almost sort of take sides in this debate about the values and what Europe stands for?
In my view, the next German leadership has to be far more outspoken on those issues. Angela Merkel, in her time as chancellor, she, in a way, never spoke up clearly against Viktor Orban, so the prime minister of Hungary, who actually for years was a member of the European People's Party, which is the conservative party family where, you know, the CDU also sits. And Merkel's attitude was to leave it to the EU institutions to handle this conflict, and she would have probably backed it up behind closed doors, but there was no public leadership on her side. And as things stand, with serious democratic backsliding in Hungary and Poland, then allegations of corruption in a number of other EU member states, it is of extremely high political importance that not only the European Commission actually runs against those countries with all the instruments that it has, but that leaders from other member states actually speak up more clearly for those principles. And I think the new coalition that will come into office in Germany has a hugely important role to play in that regard.
And just finally, Daniela, on that, what is your expectation, if you could say, what kind of coalition government you think we're going to see after Sunday?
It is highly unclear, and that is not a satisfying answer, because, first of all, we have a difference of about 3 to 4 percentage points between the two leading candidates, and that's Olaf Scholz, the Social Democrat, and Armin Laschet, the Christian Democrat. And within the margin of error of opinion polls, we actually really don't know whether that's the result we will see. If either of them varies by 2 to 3 percentage points, you know, the result will be different. And so what I think we will see is a coalition which will have 3 parties in it. So it's either Social Democrat-led, which is the more probable scenario at the moment, and then probably with the Greens and the Liberals. But we may also see a scenario where either Armin Laschet wins in the first place as the Christian Democrat candidate, or where the Social Democrats don't manage to actually form a government because the Liberals may actually pull out. And in that scenario, and that's not very probable but still possible, we may actually have a Christian Democrat chancellor, although he hasn't won the elections on Sunday.
That was Daniela Schwarzer at the Open Society Foundations. You are listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Chris Chermak. We are heading to Athens now for an update from our very own Quality of Life conference that has been full of life running throughout the morning. To give us a bit of a rundown, Monocle's own Tom Edwards is joining us now from the Greek capital. Take it away, Tom.
Well, yeah, good afternoon to you, Chris. The sun is shining, the beautiful surrounds of the Benaki Museum, Piraeus Branch. A few cabs went to the wrong place on the way. But it's certainly the perfect setting for our Quality of Life conference, which makes a return after an over-long hiatus. Andrew Tucker's alongside me. He's been on, I don't know, about 50 panels already this morning. But Andrew, yeah, set the scene first of all and just tell us a few impressions on how the morning's gone so far.
Well, I'll set the scene that I can smell the nice lunch downstairs and you and me are stuck up here at the table broadcasting on Monocle 24. It's quite hard to sum up what's happened this morning because we have done the gritty. We've had the US ambassador, Jeffrey Pyatt, here talking about ructions in the Eastern Med and the role that Greece can play and soft power influences. We've had a private detective on stage, Tyler Maroney, talking about his investigations and why he's become the go-to person for lots of media companies. And then we've just had, again, hard to sum it up, Katerina Vrana, who's a Greek comedian who became sick a couple of years ago, has ended up in a wheelchair, nearly lost her sight, and makes fun of that and anybody who happens to be next to her, which happened, I'm very pleased to say, it was Mr. Robert Bound. And she was on a panel where we were asking her to teach the audience to speak Greek. She did teach them quite a few bad words, I would say. Let's simply just say bad words.
There was some pretty robust language from ructions in the Eastern Med. Katerina kept wanting to bring it back to ructions in Robert Bound's trousers.
Yes.
Andrew, it was bordering on the indecent, but it was all done with a smile, and that's kind of... Well, it's long been the kind of Monocle approach and on Monocle 24, and it permeates the conference as well, doesn't it? As you said, we don't shy away from asking some tough questions, getting some real big hitters in there, but it's all done with a smile and a wink, or some other hand gestures in Katerina's case.
Yes, I don't think there are kind of many other kind of luxury companies or luxury conferences or highbrow conferences like this where it ends up talking about sexual behaviour in the bedroom and what she might do to Robert Bound, and did anyone else in the audience want to get involved? So what was funny was it's just these moments that you see the power of comedy to bring people together. It's levity. It just everybody was laughing, and they'd had a full morning of amazing information, and now you can hear the hubbub coming from downstairs. And again, that's the thing I love about this conference here. People didn't know each other yesterday, and now they're all kind of like, oh my god.
And Andrew, I guess if we take a step back, that's really something that's super important. And actually, that's run through all of the conversations we've had. We've spent an evening or two with lots of the other delegates, with our hosts, with the panelists, and with some of our new dear friends from City Hall, of course, here in Athens, and from central government as well, and from all over the world. There's been a real appetite, not just for the cheese ding-dongs, that's mainly me, but a real appetite... just to get together. You know, I said it's been a hiatus. We obviously didn't have any conference last year, and you can really feel this, you know, reinvigorated desire for travel, for companionship, to get these conversations going. People have been starved of these moments, haven't they? And it's almost palpable, that feeling.
Well, we just did a who's in the room, and the biggest number of people have come here from the US. When you think of the complicated ways we have to travel these days, how amazing that all these Americans have come here. And again, many of them have said, this is the first time I've been out of the country in like 18 months. It's the first time I've traveled. And they're here and they want to share ideas and they want to connect with all these people. Huge team from the UAE as well. So it's been really fascinating to see who's rocked up. And I would just say on the food thing, I did think it was a bit rude last night when you pushed all the speakers out of the way to get to the puddings first.
Andrew, there were two oversized chocolate mousses. What was I supposed to do?
Well, I thought when you said, can I take them home with me, that was also pushing your luck.
Well, I filled up the pockets of my light jacket. That one won't be going to the dry cleaner, straight in the bin. Just briefly, let me ask you a final question. Another treasure trove of expertise, of entertainment, of delights known and unexpected ahead of us this afternoon. Any highlight in particular, or can you look beyond how we're wrapping up the day with our good friend Chandra in a few hours' time?
Well, Chandra Kurt's going to be here, and we're going to be doing a wine tasting. And even that, I think it's going to be now done outdoors. It was going to be done indoors. We're ad-libbing a little bit there, so we'll see what happens. But I'm also on a panel which is important to me, and I think important to Monocle, which is this panel about Beirut and what will happen there. And we have Bernard Khoury, the architect. We have Rana Salam, an amazing designer, and Nada Deb, another great designer, all here from Beirut to talk about what happens next for that city. Not all easy, but you know, quality of life isn't just a sunny thing. It's about an aspiration. It's about something to be delivered for everybody, not for an elite. It's a meaningful phrase, quality of life, and we're going to be unpacking that this afternoon.
Andrew's going to be unpacking an oversized Greek salad in the next 60 seconds. Andrew, I'll let you get on with that. Chris, I'll throw it back to you in the studio. Of course, listeners should stay tuned to Monocle 24 over the next few days. We'll have other highlights in the mix, and we'll be back in London eventually, and we'll tell you more about it firsthand. But for now, back to you, Chris, and the briefing team.
Tom, thank you so much for that. Go get your lunch. Enjoy a little break. That was Tom Edwards and Andrew Tuck in Athens. We will, of course, as Tom said, have much more from the Quality of Life Conference for you throughout the day today. You are listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's program, Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller, brings us his own unique take on what the last 7 days have taught us.
We learned this week that the sinister deep state, which furtively manipulates human destiny for its own nefarious ends, plans to infuse the sinister serum they market as a COVID-19 vaccine into salad dressing. So there was that. Let's have a chorus of everyone agreeing that this sounds both normal and plausible.
Oh, yeah, it's the Quality of Life conference this weekend, so everyone's in Athens. Also, I just can't be bothered.
Great work, team! We learned the salad dressing thing from no less a source than American Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, former director of the US Defense Intelligence Agency and National Security Advisor, now apparently an ambassador at large for QAnon, who spends his days barking at podcasts for weirdos, which is a reassuring career path.
I gotta put, you know, somebody sent me a thing this morning where they're talking about putting the vaccine into salad dressing.
We did learn, however, that outlandish though Flynn's claims may seem, they are rigorously sourced and diligently fact-checked. We emphasize, somebody sent me a thing this morning where they're talking about it. For perspective, next time one of Flynn or his ilk tease off about the fake news media, here is the sound of an actual editor responding to a reporter who attempts to fly a kite on a string quite that frayed. That was supposed to be evocative of someone careening headlong down a staircase, boot print in seat of trousers, laptop and notepad flung after them, battered trilby with card reading press tucked into the hatband, wafting mournfully in their wake. Our producers always greatly enjoy rising to the challenge of making these directions a reality for the enjoyment of you, the listener.
Yep, fine. I've totally got all day for this nonsense. It's not like I've got a billion other things on my plate.
That's the spirit. Let's have some wistful music. Because if only there was some way of seamlessly proceeding from a riff about journalists who write meretricious nonsense based on thin or non-existent evidence to an item involving former Daily Telegraph Brussels correspondent Boris Johnson. But there's just nothing, nothing at all to work with here. Or so our lawyer tells us, you can stop soaking everything in paraffin now, Lionel. Bring on the accordions. For we learned that the United Kingdom as a nation should be grateful at a moment of tumultuous trans-channel brouhaha about submarines or whatever it is this time, that it is led by a skillful and sensitive diplomat who can absolutely be relied on not to make matters worse.
I just think it's time for some of our dearest friends around the world to, you know, prenez un grip about all this, and donnez-moi un break.
That Boris Johnson did not make this statement while wearing a beret, a hooped shirt, and draped in onions is an inexcusable dereliction by his staff, for which we hope someone is being appropriately punished. See, you've got two goes out of it now, Christy. A morning well spent.
No, honestly, I've got absolutely nothing better to do.
We also learned from Boris Johnson's recent diplomatic forays that while there may be audiences receptive to excruciatingly laboured invocations of Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, the United Nations General Assembly is not among them.
And when Kermit the Frog sang, "It's not easy being green." Do you remember that one? I want you to know that he was wrong. He was wrong. It is easy. It's not only easy, it's lucrative, and it's right to be greedy. But although he was also unnecessarily rude to Miss Piggy, I thought, Kermit the Frog.
Tough crowd. We know the feeling. Maestro, the national anthem of El Salvador. Isn't that the William Tell Overture? All right, crack on. We learned from El Salvador, which translates as The Salvador, it's not just Boris Johnson who can do this, that their experiment with the world's first hipster president continues to take disconcerting turns. We had already learned early on that 40-year-old Nayib Bukele, for it is he, appeared determined to conform to every sour caricature of the unjustifiably self-pleased millennial. Mannered beard, baseball cap on backwards, has probably at least thought about a man bun and sleeve tattoos, may well grind own coffee. We need some generic hipster music. What do generic hipsters listen to? Christ, what a din. We subsequently learned that Bukele was hell-bent on pursuing the shtick to the point of absurdity, adopting 21st century magic beans Bitcoin as legal tender for El Salvador, which certainly seems very much like something which could not possibly go wrong. We have now learned that Bukele, who already had considerable form for tweeting every damn thing that pops into his head, has submitted completely to the embrace of poster's disease, which afflicts its victims with a kind of morbid contrarianism. We learn that President Bukele now describes himself as follows, as read by Monocle 24's ironic tyranny desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
El dictador más cool del mundo mundial.
Which translates, we learned, roughly as the coolest dictator in the world. Well, quite. While we, for one sidelong look at the news monologue, would never instruct the voters of El Salvador or anywhere else how to conduct their affairs, we're good like that, we have learned from general observation that there really is only one appropriate response to this sort of grandstanding by a head of state, even, perhaps especially, if made in jest. Three goes you've had out of that now. Three.
Yeah? You want a fourth? I'll give you a fourth. Wasting my time like this, I'll buy three you down the steps.
For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Miller.
There is music that sounds from the street. There are lights in the clouds and there's ghosts all around. Hear a voice as it's rolling and ringing through me.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and especially Christy, who of course had nothing better to do than to put that together. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James, our researcher was Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager was Nora Hull. The Briefing is back on Monday, but we will have more analysis of the day's top news stories on the Monocle Daily, which airs at 1800 London time. I'm Chris Chermak, goodbye and thanks for listening.